Good morning, everyone, and Happy New Year, both to those of you who have joined us today, but also to those who are at home viewing this event. I'm Dimitri Papadimitriou, President of the Migration Policy Institute, and I would like to welcome you all to the discussion of the Institute's latest report with the title of Immigration Enforcement in the United States, the Rise of a Formidable Machinery. And as you will see during the presentations, and as you will conclude after the event is over, indeed, it is a formidable machinery that has been created in the United States over the past decade or decade and a half. The release of this report could not come at a more appropriate time. Since the election, but even before that, the president and leaders in the Democratic Party in the U.S. Congress, both chambers of the U.S. Congress, as well as key Republican leaders, have repeatedly said that this is the time for a broad reform of the U.S. immigration system. We can only take them at their word, I think. If this were to indeed take place, it would end a 10-year deadlock with repeated failed attempts in reforming the system, most notably the failures of 2006 and 2007. Undergirding these failures has been deep skepticism shared by many analysts, some advocates, and significant portions of the U.S. population about the ability and will of the U.S. government to enforce the law at the borders and in the U.S. interior. This so-called demand for enforcement first led the Migration Policy Institute and my colleagues on the panel to invest in understanding as well as it is possible the investments, effectiveness, and consequences, including the human consequences of the nation's deep commitment to enforcement and the rule of law, once more, both at the border and at the nation's interior. My colleagues will detail their findings, but I want to emphasize that no nation anywhere in the world has been as determined, has made as deep and expensive a commitment to, or has had as deep a reach in its enforcement efforts as the U.S. has had. A reach that spans from local courtrooms and jails all the way to the ability of would-be travelers to the United States to actually be able to travel to the United States, including be able to really get on a plane to come to the United States. An extension of U.S. borders well beyond the physical borders of the United States. This is not the first time that the Migration Policy Institute has really delved deeply into enforcement issues. I think we deeply believe that immigration enforcement is key to the immigration system's integrity and to the ability of a government to do the smart things that it must do in order to take advantage of the opportunities that international migration makes possible. In fact, we have issued major report going back almost to the beginning of the Migration Policy Institute, now 11 years ago, with reports following 9/11, in-depth investigations and reports of the visa system, and a series of reports on the evolution of enforcement systems and cooperation, transatlantically. Today's report is in that tradition and details the extent to which and the reach that our enforcement efforts have actually enabled us to do. And make no mistake, and as my colleagues again will show, it is indeed a system that we now have, a system in which the whole is bigger, much bigger than the sum of its parts. Let me tell you a bit about the choreography of the event and the order in which our speakers will present their findings. I will say a couple of words about each one of them and the topics that they will address. We'll start with Doris Meissner, a Migration Policy Institute senior fellow and director of the U.S. Immigration Program. And for those of you who might not know, the Immigration Commissioner under the Clinton presidency. Doris will present the overview of the report and the report on border enforcement and data systems. She will also summarize the conversation after her colleagues have spoken. The second speaker is Muzaffer Çiçti, director of the Migration Policy Institute's office at New York University Law School, who will present the parts of the report that deal with workplace enforcement and the interplay with the criminal justice system. The third speaker will be Don Kerwin, who is the director of the Center for Migration Studies in New York and a non-resident fellow at the Institute. Don will be talking about detention and removals. The fourth author of the report, Claire Bergeron, is not a presenter, but she's sitting right there. So I am sure that some of your questions Claire will field, and I would like to thank Claire very much for all of her efforts, as well as thank my colleagues for this extraordinary report that I know you will all enjoy very much. Thank you very much, and Doris, would you please come to the podium?
Okay, good morning. Thank you very much, Dimitri. Good morning, and my wishes for a happy 2013 as well. We're talking this morning about immigration enforcement, as Dimitri, of course, has teed up. You know, it's often said that there is no agreement in the country on immigration policy, and that we are deeply divided and so forth. These are common things that we hear. Of course they're true. Of course we're deeply divided. But in fact, there really has been one element of immigration policy that's been a source of support across the board for a very long time, and that has been strengthened enforcement, especially border enforcement and deportations or removals. So MPI has worked, of course, on enforcement issues from the outset. We've done reports on many different parts of this consensus, on many different programs and elements of the enforcement system. What this is an effort to look at the totality, to try to figure out, all put together, what it looks like and what it means. And I think that this is probably the first such effort that has been made to try to stitch it together and to try to determine what is the larger story here from this consensus on immigration enforcement that, in fact, has been so much a part of the immigration debate but not really understood in that way. We start with IRCA as the starting point, and we start with IRCA, which is now more than 25 years ago, the Immigration Reform and Control Act of 1986, as a landmark of the beginning of what we think of as the current era of immigration enforcement. We define it that way because although there has always been border enforcement, IRCA was an effort for the first time to try to create a systemic response to the issues of illegal immigration facing the country. And, of course, that systemic response was to attempt to strengthen border enforcement, combine it with employer sanctions, to create employer accountability within the country, and that, of course, balanced by a legalization program. We all know that IRCA was only partially successful, and it was more successful on the legalization side than it was on the enforcement side. So that starting point is a starting point, but it obviously was insufficient to meet the demands of enforcement during the past 25 years. I think the next important development has been legislation that passed in 1996, really two pieces of legislation, but we think of them as the 1996 laws. And they added very strong statutory powers to the enforcement regime and strengthened enforcement through statutory changes. They included many mandates, which you'll hear more about subsequently, but many of the mandates that they did include became important only more recently in the last 10 years rather than right after the 1996 laws, such things as employer verification, mandates for entry-exit requirements, expedited exclusion, and many others date from that time. 9/11, of course, was the next pivotal event. And 9/11, of course, is pivotal because it embedded national security into every aspect of immigration enforcement. It led to the creation of DHS and the breakup of INS into three enforcement agencies. It generated the idea of connecting the dots regarding information sharing in the government, which has been of paramount importance. And it generated enormous funding for at least a decade, including for immigration enforcement functions and agencies. So that brings us to the present. And the present, when you look at that picture, adds up to a story where both Republicans and Democrats in leadership roles, both in the administration and in the Congress, for more than 25 years, have supported strengthened immigration enforcement. What's emerged is what we think of and call a machinery. This report maps and it traces the rise of that machinery, hence the title of the report, and the look that we gave it, which is of an engineering manual. This is really a visual that tries to express what it is that we see in looking at the developments of the last 25 years. Now, that's an enforcement machinery that rests on what we see as six pillars. The six pillars, which are listed on your cover, are somewhat familiar and somewhat non-familiar. The familiar pillars are ones that we've heard of for many, many years: border enforcement, employer enforcement, detention and removal. But the three additional pillars, which are perhaps newer or less well understood, but very important to this overall story and to the operation of this machinery, are visa and travel screening, information and interoperability of database systems, and intersections between the immigration enforcement system and the established criminal justice system. So we've organized this report around these six pillars. Each of the pillars, we devote a chapter to each of the pillars. In each of the chapters, we lay out for you all of the programs that make up that pillar, and we look at what is the known information about the results of those programs. What is it that they have generated? What is it that they have produced? All of the information is drawn from public sources. We did not work with any government agencies on this. This is all public information. It's a question of amassing it, stitching it together, and trying to figure out what it is that it actually says. The chapters also for each pillar provide critiques. They provide what are the criticisms that have been made, what have oversight bodies found about the operations of these programs, so you do have a rundown of what the critique is in all of these areas. And then we make findings. We make findings in each of the areas, each of the pillars, on what it is that the takeaways are from the experience of those programs. There are 52 findings in all. We are going to begin to go through all of them here. We're only going to touch on some of the highlight findings. But what we do not do in this report is make any recommendations. And we do not make recommendations for a reason. We don't make them because what we have wanted to do is to simply look at what it is that is in place, determine why it is significant, and how it is that we can compare it, when possible, to other reference points in the law enforcement system in order to understand relative importance of the things that we have seen. There's an enormous amount of material here. It is a broad resource. We are not going to be able to touch on very much of it in this session this morning. But in order to help you, we've also produced what you have at your place, which is a report in brief. And this is your Cliff Notes, short form. And what it includes is the introduction, the executive summary, the full list of findings, and the conclusions as a quick sort of walk-around document. You're able to find all of this on our website and download it, www.migrationpolicy.org. It's there now. And so for those of you who want to get it around to other networks, et cetera, that's an easy way to do it. Okay, now, before going to the individual pillars, let me step back and give you a rundown on the overview, because there is an overview to this whole story, which is really the sum of the parts, and the sum of the parts is the story of growth. This is fundamentally, at its heart, a story of growth. Growth in funding, in personnel, in technology, particularly in the decade since 9/11. So what we see from that story of growth are some rather dramatic, what we think of as top-line findings. The first is that spending for the immigration enforcement agencies today, adjusted for inflation, is 15 times what it was for INS in 1986 when we believe the current era of immigration enforcement began. That is a conservative estimate, and if anybody wants to parse that with us later, we would be happy to talk you through how it is that we came to that estimate, but it is a conservative estimate. Most likely the spending is somewhat, possibly considerably more than what it is that we've estimated. In relative terms, what this means is that the United States government now spends more on immigration enforcement than on all other principal law enforcement agencies combined. We are spending, as of fiscal year 2011, which is the most recent year for the data that we're using that was available, that's a price tag of $18 billion. That is 24% greater than the $14.4 billion that funds the FBI, the DEA, the Secret Service, the ATF, and the U.S. Marshals Service. This is a historic reversal because in 1986, when this all began, INS comprised less than 25% of the spending of all of the other law enforcement agencies. And if you look at page 22 of your engineering manual, you will see a graph that very clearly shows this flip and what a historic change has taken place over this period of time. Border enforcement, of course, is by far the largest share of this spending. It's the largest spending for everything in the immigration system, all of the other immigration functions. And among other things, it's made possible the doubling of the Border Patrol in just the last 8 years, from 10,819 to where it stands today, which is in the neighborhood of 21,370. But even though CBP and its growth is enormous, the growth of ICE is also very substantial. And that growth has been 87% since 2005, from a number of 3.1 billion to today about 5.9 billion. So those are the big framing points that I hope paint the picture of what it is that we're doing in this report. Let me now go to the couple pillars that I'm going to say some things about and then turn it to my colleagues. The first of the pillars that we discuss is, as you would imagine, border enforcement. And that, of course, is the most long-standing of the elements of the immigration enforcement system and surely the most visible and well-known. But in addition to the resource story, which is the fundamental story about border enforcement, and also the emphasis on national security, which is now so prominent in border enforcement functions and in thinking, there are two other key developments that I want to pull out of this report to just highlight for a moment here. One is that the Border Patrol announced a new strategic plan last spring, which did not get very much attention at all. But it is a strategic plan, which is a four-year plan. It's established for 2012 through 2016. And it is quite remarkable in that compared with anything that we've seen in the past as strategic plans for the Border Patrol, it calls for risk-based enforcement and says that its resource base has been built. Therefore, the resource base that is in place allows for responses to be targeted based on information and integration of efforts and rapid response. It is not projecting a need for additional resources. It depicts a steady state of refining its programs and remarkably talks a great deal about cooperation with other countries, particularly cross-border cooperation with Mexico. So that's quite a notable change from what we have seen in the past. The other thing about the border enforcement pillar that is very significant to understand in terms of the rest of what it is that is going to be talked about is something called the consequence delivery system. The consequence delivery system, or we are calling it consequence enforcement as a shorthand, is based on the fact that the sustained level of resource infusions that have taken place for border enforcement have allowed for significant changes in enforcement practices. Instead of the revolving door, which is, of course, the enduring image of Southwest land border enforcement, what is happening now is that the Border Patrol is employing enforcement tactics that impose consequences beyond simple voluntary return on almost everyone that is arrested at the Southwest border. The purpose, they say, is to break smuggling cycles and to disrupt the networks that sustain illegal immigration, and the effort is to separate the illegal migrant from the smuggler and thereby raise the cost. Examples of consequence enforcement are lateral repatriation. You get arrested in one place, you get returned in a place far away. Expedited removal, which is in wide-scale spread use now at the Southwest border. Operation Streamline, which is something that many of you have heard about. But the result is that whereas in the past we've basically had a set of practices at the Southwest border where 90% of the people arrested were voluntarily returned, and therefore this revolving door pattern of behavior, that is now entirely flipped. Voluntary return is the exception. It is being used only, by and large, in humanitarian cases under special circumstances. It is the exception, not the rule. So there are consequences much greater for people who do attempt to cross, and that is having significant downstream effects, again, as is evident in the rest of the report and probably will be touched on by my colleagues. Significant effects both on the migrants themselves and on the system itself and other agencies. So among the findings where border enforcement is concerned are historic highs in staffing, technology infrastructure, as against 40-year now lows in apprehensions. Apprehensions just since 2008 have fallen 53%. At the same time, the enforcement has been significantly strengthened between ports of entry. Ports of entry themselves have lagged behind and could very well become a weak link of Southwest border enforcement. They may already be. The needs with land border port enforcement particularly rest on infrastructure, where the infrastructure is simply not able to deal with the technology advances that indeed have been made to deal with more effective crossing. But as the Southwest land border enforcement does improve, what we are going to see is an increasing share of the unauthorized population in the United States, to the extent that it continues to exist, be made up of visa overstayers rather than of people crossing the border without documents. And that would also likely then change the ethnic and nationality makeup of the unauthorized population, because it would be far less people coming from Mexico and Central America than from other countries around the world. So the next one that we talk about is travel and visa screening, and that is a subset of border enforcement. It has become very successful as well, but it is heavily dependent on data issue improvements, and I'm going to skip the travel screening, therefore, and go to the data issue improvements, because that is a third pillar that is a relatively new dimension of enforcement as we see it. The information and data interoperability changes that have taken place really rise to the level of being an impeller because they are so significant. It's hard to overstate the importance of the database changes and immigration enforcement. Major investments have been made in building and linking databases across law enforcement and intelligence agencies, and the access to this information enables searches of terrorist connections, criminal background, and immigration history at every step in the admissions and immigration processes. The heart of this is IDENT, the biometric fingerprint system. That's the key database, and although it dates back into the 1990s, it really has had enormous investment and expansion since 9/11. IDENT now stores over 148 million records. They grow at a rate of 10 million a year. It is the largest law enforcement biometric database in the world. It's enabled advances in all of the other pillars. Protocols that rely on comprehensive information and interoperability of data systems are now embedded in all critical immigration processes and practices. Today, non-citizens are screened at more times against more databases which contain more detailed data than ever before. So the significance of these new capabilities becomes very clear in discussing the other pillars, which my colleagues will take up in order, beginning with Muzaffer Shishti.
Thank you, Doris. And Muz, yes, sir. As efficiently as you possibly can make it.
Thank you so much, and good morning and Happy New Year to all of you. I'll go as quickly as I can, talk as fast as my natural tendency is. I'll deal with the two pillars, the workplace enforcement and the intersection of criminal justice system and immigration enforcement. On the workforce enforcement, Doris, as you just heard, refers to 1986 IRCA as the dawn of the current era on immigration. For those of us who cut our teeth in the 1986 law, and almost all of these members of the panel except Don, who was too young to be involved, I'm not sure that feels like a compliment. But I think it reminded us that when we do these exercises in legislation making, that each sediment is based on something else. And the whole machinery that we have built today is essentially built on milestones, some of them major and some of them minor. 1986 was a major milestone in America's commitment to immigration enforcement. I think students of immigration history today will not recognize how important philosophically that shift was. Before 1986, it's safe to say that employers in the country thought that the ability to hire unauthorized workers was as sacrosanct as the Second Amendment, that it was their God's right in the capitalist system to hire anyone that they wanted. That understanding fundamentally altered in 1986. It was so controversial that in the whole spectrum, from the Chamber of Commerce to the ACLU, opposed employer sanctions. And despite that opposition, Congress enacted the employer sanctions laws in 1986. As all of you know, it ushered in the sanctions to employers for hiring unauthorized workers. But it was soon clear that this was not a very effective new law enforcement tool for two reasons. Employers figured that there was very little compliance with the law from the law enforcement agencies. And two, they found it very easy to comply with the law by just using a large number of documents that could meet the requirement of the law. Many of them could be fraudulently obtained. Therefore, since then, government has been trying to see whether there could be a more automated electronic verification system to get around the proliferation of the documents that were used to meet the compliance of employer sanctions law. And beginning 1996, we started testing various programs to do this thing in an electronic, automated way. In 1996, Congress authorized the basic pilot, which by now in 2007 is now called the E-Verify program. And this is a voluntary program in which people, employers, give the information about the identity and the authorization to work of a job applicant, which is screened against SSA's and DHS's database to determine the eligibility to work. Now, this, the basic pilot program, as I said, is a voluntary program, but it has grown exponentially while we have been testing it as a voluntary program. Just to put it in context, in 2006, there are only 10,000 employers who were enrolled in the Verify program. Currently, there are about 354,000 employers enrolled in the Verify program. Last year, we checked 17 million queries a year are sent through the E-Verify program. And this that may represent a lot to you, but it still represents only 10% of U.S. business establishments. While the E-Verify has gone on at the federal level, we all know that states have been busy enacting their own state E-Verify laws. It's a trend that started in Colorado and was made most notorious by Arizona's law in 2007, which went all the way up to the Supreme Court. And in 2011, July, the Supreme Court upheld the legality of the state E-Verify laws, with the result that today there are 19 states in the country which allow some or all employers to be enrolled in E-Verify. Now, E-Verify, many of you know, has suffered from a lot of criticism, that it generates false positives, it generates false negatives. But studies done over time have also shown that these error rates have steadily gone down. In fact, the General Accounting Office's most recent report found the error rate is now pretty close to about 2.6%. So therefore, while it has grown, it has also improved. But there is one element in the E-Verify which has not actually kept pace with the demands, which is the ability to identify the applicants whose data is actually presented to databases. We don't have a very good photo matching ability that would say that the person whose information is being sent is actually the person who is being hired. But despite these weaknesses, E-Verify, one has to say, has left the station. It is not anymore a reversible phenomenon. Those who thought that the pilot programs could result in the termination of the E-Verify, I think that speculation is over. E-Verify will remain a permanent part of our immigration legal system. The only issue is at what pace and in what levels will it become mandatory, and how do we improve the deficiencies that are currently in the system. There have to be two other developments, which I'll quickly touch on the workforce enforcement system. One, I think many of you know that the Obama administration fundamentally shifted its policy in worksite enforcement by moving away from targeting unauthorized immigrants through high-profile raids to targeting actually employers who hire unauthorized workers. Since January of 2009, ICE has audited more than 8,000 employers. It has debarred 726 companies and imposed about $88 million in criminal monetary fines on employers, a very significant departure from the past trend. And the last thing on the worksite enforcement I want to touch on is that there has been an increased effort in the labor standards enforcement in our country. We all know that labor standards enforcement always takes less priority in our overall enforcement system. There are only 1,100 inspectors in the wage and hour division to monitor about more than 7.5 million U.S. business establishments. That obviously is not going to do the job as efficiently as one would like to. Therefore, the Department of Labor has more recently gone into more smarter, more targeted enforcement of those employers who habitually violate laws on the books for labor standards, and in a concept called fissured industries, where there are major dominant employers who may be outsourcing or who may be franchising or who may be the top level of the supply chain, the Department of Labor is increasingly going after the big dominant employers for the violations of the lower chain supply. Let me shift quickly to the intersection of immigration and criminal justice system. I think if I said that 1986 was a philosophical departure, I think students of immigration history 50 years from now will definitely agree that in the immigration enforcement history, 1996 will go down as the before Christ and after Christ moment in our enforcement strategy. It was for the first time many of us who were there, unfortunately, involved in that exercise from outside and inside the government, know that Congress, to keep intact the legal immigration system, decided to enact measures which essentially scorched earth policy towards unauthorized immigrants and especially immigrants with criminal history. And it unleashed in the process an extraordinary, unprecedented intersection between our criminal justice system and immigration enforcement. Clearly unprecedented in immigration history, I would like to say it's also unprecedented in almost any enforcement regime in our history. And it did by a series of developments, which are many of you are familiar with them. I summarize them as five developments which have led to the trend which has produced the number of removals in the country today, which Don will talk about. The first is that we made more immigration violations that used to be civil violations into federal crimes. We impose new initiatives and funding target those crimes for prosecution which were now made crimes. And we increased the number of federal and state crimes which have the automatic consequence of removal from the country. Fourth is that we removed the discretion of immigration judges to consider positive equities that could be taken into account before as someone could be removed from the country. And last is that we initiated new programs, mostly cooperative federal and state and local programs, where we funnel criminal suspects and criminal convicts into the removal machinery. And the results of all these five developments are starkly for all to see. First, there has been an unprecedented increase in the number of criminal prosecutions for immigration-related violations. From 01 to 09, the criminal prosecutions for immigration-related crimes rose sixfold, almost sixfold, from about 16,000 to 92,000 a year. To me, much more importantly, has been the ratio of the immigration-related crimes as a percentage of the overall federal prosecutions of all crimes. Today, immigration, in 2003, if you looked at the record, the prosecution for immigration-related crimes accounted for about 17 to 20% of all federal prosecution of crimes. In 2008, that number had jumped to 50%. That 50% of all federal prosecution of crimes are now related to immigration. To put this in context, I'll cite only three findings that we made. that if we look at today, the CBP, the Custom and Border Patrol people, refers more cases to the U.S. attorneys for criminal prosecution across the country than the FBI does. If you put the CBP and ICE together, they refer more cases for criminal prosecutions than all of DOJ's law enforcement agencies combined, the list that Morris recited for you. There are five federal judicial districts along the U.S.-Mexico border, which our crackerjack research assistants have found account for 10% of the U.S. population. They now account for half of all federal felony prosecutions in the United States. Now, many people believe that the spike in federal prosecutions is the result of a program called Operation Streamline that Doris referred to. It's a DHS program that started in one border district in 2005. Today, it has been extended to six of the all nine districts on the border. It's a scheme in which magistrate judges hear cases of federal immigration violations en masse. There are group hearings held, at the end of which people are removed from the United States. The DHS calls it the zero-tolerance policy towards unauthorized immigration and wants to treat everyone who crosses without makes an entry illegally to the funnel. Obviously, it cannot prosecute everyone, but the numbers of about 30,000 cases a year go through the Operation Streamline. The second phenomenon that has happened is that, as I mentioned, is there's an increase in the state and federal crimes that have the automatic consequences of removal. I mean, we know U.S. has not historically been very, very receptive to criminal aliens. But till recently, we only used to remove people who committed major crimes. These were crimes of moral turpitude, domestic violence, substance abuse. But in 1996, we added a category called aggravated felonies. It's a term of art which is peculiar to immigration law. It has by now come to include about 50 separate crimes in 21 different categories. Many of them are minor crimes, some are even misdemeanors. And Congress, in its wisdom, decided to apply the aggravated felony provision retroactively. So today, there are a large number of long-standing immigrants, many of them lawful permanent residents, who are being removed from their country for crimes and some minor crimes that they committed many years ago.
Moose.
As important as the legislative developments of increasing these the definition of crimes are the new cooperative agreements between states, localities, and the federal government for screening suspects for their removal. And all of you know that these are the famous programs of the Criminal Alien Program, the 287G program, the Secure Communities Program, and the Fugitive Operation Program. Just to put it in the context, the funding for these programs, which has actually really shocked me, that the funding of these programs from 04 to 011 has risen from $23 million to $690 million. Those of you who do the math, that's about 2,900% change in the funding of these programs. And obviously, the results are here to see. We have seen a huge growth in the criminal alien program, which now puts about half of all the people in immigration detention in the country. The National the Fugitive Operation Program has grown about 10 times in the last eight years. And today, only about 28% of people, unfortunately, through the Fugitive Operation Program are criminal fugitives. The 287G program, which is scaling down, still operational about 57 jurisdictions, has also scaled up tremendously in 2006 to 2008, mostly in the southeast sector of the country. About half the people who are removed through 287G program do not fit the priority levels of the government. These are not hard, dangerous criminals. And the last program, which I'll conclude with, which is the most recent entry to this collection of cooperative programs, but has now become the most dominant, is the Secure Communities Program. launched in 2008 in one jurisdiction. Today it covers about 3,074 jurisdictions. It will become universal all across the country by March of 2013. Initially, it was billed as a voluntary program.
Ms. Kim, we continue that conversation.
Yeah, but that no longer has become a voluntary program. Many states tried to opt out of the program, and in August of 2011, the DHS secretary took them out of the misery and said that every fingerprint that is submitted by the government to the federal government can be shared with any other part of the government. So the Securities Community Program, unfortunately, folks, has also left. That train has also left the station, and therefore expected to become a permanent part of our immigration enforcement system. Thank you.
Thank you. I'd like to have a real conversation with the audience, so I would appreciate it very much if we try to keep within time in order to be able to take questions. Don?
Okay. Thank you, Dimitri. Doris and Moose have moved us through this system in a somewhat linear way. My task is to talk about the removal and detention processes, which are basically the end of the line for many people who come in contact with the enforcement system. And I'll highlight four of the report's findings on removal, some parallel findings on detention, discuss detention reform, and raise one challenge related to the court system. On removal, first, as my colleagues have highlighted, removals have increased dramatically over the last quarter of a century. Since 1986, there have been more than 4 million deportations from the United States. Between FY 1990 and FY 2012, the removals rose from 30,000 a year to almost 410,000 per year. Of all the enforcement pillars, removals have the greatest impact on immigrant families and communities. One telling statistic from the report is that ICE has reported 46,486 non-citizens with a U.S. citizen child who were removed over just a six-month period in 2011. Removals have risen steadily over many administrations, Democratic and Republican, but they've certainly accelerated in recent years. The last 4 years have seen about 1.6 million removals. And I think many have questioned why an administration that's devoted to comprehensive reform would remove the greatest number of people of any administration in U.S. history. And the report provides a partial answer, at the least, which is that the legal authorities, the operational systems, the enforcement programs, and the financial investments since 1986 have made large-scale removals almost an inevitability. They've made high levels of enforcement an institutional priority and a structural reality. The fact is that the machinery is in place. As most kind of referenced, the 1996 Immigration Act, also known as IRA-IRA, was a particular turning point. It built on a trend hearkening back to 1988 of expanding the crimes leading to automatic removal and mandatory detention and limiting relief from removal. Our second finding has to do with the increased informality of the removal process. There's a widespread belief that immigrants who are facing removal have their day in court, and a judge determines whether they can stay or have to leave after a full hearing. This is no longer true for most people who are removed from the country. In fact, increasing numbers of non-citizens are being removed and expedited in summary ways. Expedited removals, for example, now account for around 30% of all removals. The expedited process is carried out by DHS and was first applied to persons encountered at ports of entry who had false documents. It's since been extended to non-citizens entering by seas, to those arrested within 100 miles of land borders, and then to all land and coastal borders in the United States. Another third of removal cases involve persons previously ordered removed who illegally reentered the country. In those cases, ICE simply reinstates the prior order of removal. There are also large numbers of administrative removals, tens of thousands each year. They involve people who are not lawful permanent residents but who've been convicted of aggravated felonies, which, as Moose mentioned, is an immigration-specific kind of expansive category of crimes. And finally, thousands are removed each year based on stipulated orders of removal. In a typical stipulated order case, an unrepresented detainee signs a form agreeing that they're removable and have no relief available, which they often do to avoid further detention. And ICE detention officers and counsel do most of the work in obtaining and filing the stipulated order, and then the immigration judge basically confirms that the order was knowingly and willingly signed. There's also a similar expedited process, but without the stipulated form, which are known as quick court proceedings. The upshot of all these developments is that there's been a growing gap between immigration judge removal orders and actual removals. In FY 2011, immigration judges issued 161,000 removal orders, but nearly 400,000 people were actually removed. Some have rule of law concerns about the increasing informality of this process. Others applaud this development. Our finding is simply that these little-known programs and authorities are being substantially used at this point. Third, as Moose described, immigration and criminal enforcement have been strongly linked in the post-IRCA era. An example, roughly 20% of criminal alien removals in 2011 were for persons who had committed immigration offenses for which they had been criminally prosecuted. That's about 20%. We've also seen growing numbers of removals of persons with criminal convictions, some for quite serious crimes and some for misdemeanors. In 2012, nearly 55% of the persons removed had been convicted of a crime. In 2008, less than a third had been. Our fourth finding is that government-directed returns have decreased dramatically over the last decade, and the proportion of returns to formal removals or deportations has reversed. What's a return? Well, DHS defines a return as a confirmed removal of an inadmissible or deportable alien, but one not based on an order of removal. Returns include what are known as voluntary departures, but they include other things as well, and of course, voluntary departures aren't really voluntary. Returns may be undercounted in the official statistics for reasons described in the report. That said, they've certainly increased overall. There were 1.7 million returns in 2000, but 323,000 in 2011, and far fewer returns than removals in 2011. Returns are normally granted to Mexican nationals and, to a lesser extent, Canadian nationals. So you'd expect to see fewer given decreases in illegal crossings. However, this trend is also consistent with the notion of consequence enforcement, which Doris mentioned, since a formal removal triggers a 10-year bar on readmission and a return does not. Like removals, detention numbers have increased dramatically since 1986, particularly since 1996, I'd say. Between 95 and 2011, the average daily immigrant detention population rose from about 7,500 to about 33,300. ICE now detains 430,000 persons in any given year. To give you a sense of the system's size, the Bureau of Prisons holds more prisoners per night than ICE does immigrants, but BOP holds fewer people over a year than ICE does. As with removals, a rising number of ICE detainees, nearly 200,000 in 2011, had criminal records, and these included both felonies and misdemeanors. In 2011, ICE reported classifying only about 19% of detainees, however, in its highest risk category. ICE also places substantial numbers of persons in alternative to detention programs. These programs have various degrees of reporting requirements and restrictions, including electronic monitoring and home and office visits. They've produced extremely high appearance rates, as have past supervised release programs. Thus, they meet the main purpose of detention, which is to ensure removal, and they cost far less than holding immigrants in jails or in prisons. ICE's FY 2013 budget request is for $2 million for detention operations, but only $2 billion for detention operations, but a relatively modest $112 million for alternatives to detention. Reform of the detention system was a priority and has been of the Obama administration, and the guiding principle or insight has been that nobody in ICE custody is actually serving a prison sentence, no matter what their backgrounds are. So the idea has been to transform a prison-like system into one in keeping with ICE's civil detention authorities and the civil detainees that it keeps. The challenges that DHS is facing and have faced are immense. In 2009, at the outset of this process, the ICE detention system consisted of around 350 facilities, mostly contract facilities with states, localities, and for-profit prisons, and most privately administered. So oversight has been a major challenge. Another challenge has been the broad mandatory detention rules and ICE's interpretation of those rules that prevent it from releasing persons who, with appropriate conditions, would not be a flight risk. ICE treats even the most restrictive of its programs as alternatives to detention, not alternative forms of detention, which would open up those programs to mandatory detainees. And a final challenge has been the lack of experience and expertise of immigration officials in administering a program of this complexity, diversity, and size. Unlike BOP, this isn't what DHS was mostly built or structured to do. As part of its reform efforts, DHS has expanded alternative programs, created a risk assessment tool to determine who's a flight risk or a danger to others, and where to place individual detainees within the system, revised its immigration detention standards to make them more performance-based, extensive, and detailed, centralized management of its contract facilities, and took steps to better monitor and enforce contract compliance, and also terminated dozens of detention contracts and renegotiated others, and opened the first civil detention facility in Karnes, Texas. But these have been very significant steps. However, many groups have raised concerns, including the American Bar Association most recently, that the emerging system will still be governed by standards developed for prisoners in pretrial custody and not for civil detainees, and that most detainees will still be held in prisons or prison-like settings. Finally, a couple of quick points on the immigration court system. It operates out of DOJ's Executive Office for Immigration Review. There's 59 courts, slightly less than 260 judges, and a budget of about $300 million per year. Compare that to the $18 billion of the CBP and ICE budgets. The court system doesn't dispense perfect justice or afford full due process protections. No system does. One due process challenge has been that 85% of detainees and 50% of all cases in removal are unrepresented, and yet having counsel has been shown to substantially influence case outcomes, as does the particular judge assigned to the case. While most removals now occur through less formal means than full hearings, the court system still handles a very large and a growing volume of cases as the result of DHS's enforcement buildup. But adjudication resources haven't kept pace with those of the DHS enforcement agencies that feed into the system. The report finds that issuance of notices to appear for removal proceedings come from all three DHS immigration agencies, ICE, CBP, and surprisingly, USCIS in large numbers as well. As a result, since 2006, backlogs of court cases have nearly doubled. As of November 2012, there were 321,000 pending cases, and these cases had been pending on average for 529 days, and 777 days for those cases where relief is ultimately granted. I think there's a very strong consensus that these kinds of delays ill-serve U.S. immigration enforcement goals, increase costs, and punish those who are ultimately granted relief. Yet it's not clear how this problem will be fixed. Immigration judges now have dockets of more than 1,000 cases each. Judges in detention centers have dockets that are far larger. Removal cases are time-consuming. The laws have become more complicated over the years, and the cases are also factually complex. There's been a DOJ hiring freeze in place since January of 2011, although EIR can backfill IJ positions. On the other hand, we're seeing that filings of removal cases in court have decreased over the last year by 25%. The main point I wanted to make on courts is that there's an imbalance of resources between enforcement and adjudication, although both are part and parcel of the same system. Thank you.
Thanks. Doris now will spend exactly 5 minutes.
Less.
Less than 5 minutes, and I thank you very much, Don, for keeping in time.
Okay, so try to put all of this together. What do we see? We've given you a smattering of what it is that is in the report. There is a great deal more. But when you look at this whole picture, when you examine the evidence, What you see is the emergence of a complex, modernized, cross-agency system organized around these six pillars, as we call them. It's been institutionalized through strong links with national security and national security imperatives, as well as unprecedented resource investments. Against that backdrop, against that 25-plus years of evolution that has brought us to this point, the recession came along and fundamentally altered the illegal immigration picture, which this is attempting to solve. So, because of reduced job demand in the United States, and also, coincidentally, significant structural changes in conditions in Mexico, the growth of unauthorized immigration in the United States is at a standstill. Strengthened enforcement has become the additional element that is part of the combination of factors that explain that change. So it's fair to say, I think, that as a result of more than 25 years of investment and effort, an immigration law enforcement bulwark is in place that responds to the rule of law and the enforcement-first concerns that have driven Congress and the nation's immigration debate for more than 25 years, particularly during the last decade. It's an imperfect system. It would benefit from recalibration in many areas, but it is a sound, lasting structure that ranks as the federal government's most expensive and costly law enforcement effort at the present time. Nonetheless, enforcement standing alone is not proving sufficient, as we know, to answer the broad challenges that both illegal and legal immigration pose for the country. We need enforceable laws that address inherent weaknesses in the enforcement system, and there is statutory change that could help to improve the law enforcement system, but we also need enforceable laws that rationalize immigration policy to align with the nation's broader growth needs. So what we're saying here is that a formidable enforcement machinery has been built. It can serve the national interest well if it now also provides a platform from which to address the broader immigration policy changes suited to the larger needs and challenges that immigration represents for the United States in the 21st century. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Doris, and thanks to all of our speakers and the authors for this exceptionally comprehensive report. I'd like to open the floor to questions. Please identify yourselves, wait for the microphone to get to you, and let's start.
Sure, thank you. I'm John Gramlich. I'm a reporter with CQ Roll Call covering immigration. And my question is just, given the debate that is expected here in a few weeks on Capitol Hill, I'm wondering whether expanded pathways to legal status for those here illegally, how would that change the cost calculus going forward? Do you expect this growth in cost to continue, or are there ways to slow it?
Who wants to take this?
I think I would. I'll take it because I think that one of the things that we didn't talk about is the fiscal realities that are very much now part of the enforcement picture. I don't think that there's any question but that the funding of immigration agencies and enforcement functions is going to it's probably not going to decrease, but it is certainly likely to be on a straight line. So straight-line funding leads to far more focus on efficiency and effective programs, looking at outcomes, measuring, assessing, evaluation, et cetera. And that keeps you within the box of what is presently going on, so I think that's going to be happening in any event. But, obviously, if the Congress decides on a much bigger redesign of immigration, there will be very strong cost implications, and there will be different ways that this enforcement machinery can be used to enforce the law, but also to implement changes and relieve some of the pressure on some of the enforcement that it presently is doing.
If I may piggyback on this question, and perhaps others can weigh in, because that's an extremely important question. I think, Doris, you're basically saying that inertia alone suggests that we're going to continue with very large numbers, removals, detention, et cetera, et cetera. But if I could add another variable, which is not just the issue of resources alone, but the issue of change in methodologies as we move to risk management methodologies, both in terms of interior enforcement and border enforcement, are we not likely to see a perhaps less indiscriminate detention and deportations of people? And the formula, which has already been shifting, you know, in favor of deporting real bad actors, to continue to go upwards.
I think you see that in all of what it is that the enforcement agencies are expressing. You certainly see that in what the Border Patrol is talking about for its next period. Definitely ICE, in its effort to manage its deportation and removal responsibilities, has tried very hard to target and determine what are the high priorities. But referring to the question, let's just talk about the elephant in the room. If the Congress decides on a legal status program of some kind, that removes an enormous number of people from the potentially removable population, and underscores much more fully what you're saying, Dimitri, which is that the people who can't qualify for that are likely to have a criminal background of some kind, and then that becomes very much a more concentrated effort where interior enforcement is concerned.
John?
Yeah, just to talk from the perspective of the court system, it seems to me that broad reform could change a lot, depending on how it's structured, of course. And what you might see, of course, is a lot of cases getting closed, administratively closed in court, but I would say that in the long term, then the cases become more complex and they kind of may not return to the same level, but they may be those tougher cases that Doris and Dimitri have mentioned.
More questions? Please, ma'am.
I'm wondering if you could explore to what extent you found that the oversight or accountability mechanisms for this, enforcement machinery have kept pace with the actual growth of the enforcement machinery beyond the judicial review, but other oversight or accountability mechanisms.
And
my name is Shana. I'm with the U.S. Jesuit Conference.
Thank you.
I take it by that you mean Inspector General reports, internal audit efforts, et cetera. It's hard to say. In the first place, there have been such high rates of growth, high percentage rates of growth. I mean, when agencies grow at levels of 20, 25, 30% in a budget year, and that has happened in some of these years in the last decade, you can't ever, the accountability mechanisms never can keep up with that. So I think that we can probably just infer that there has not been the kind of oversight. But in addition to that, it's also the case that these agencies are not terribly transparent, nor is DHS particularly transparent. So the degree to which there may be oversight taking place or not is not something that is easy to determine from, given the research that's available. There certainly are lots of GAO reports, lots of Inspector General reports. They're all detailed in our footnotes and so forth. But there are unquestionably programs and not particularly program results and use of funds and outcomes research, overall metrics, et cetera, that just haven't been developed and need to be developed.
Thank you, Doris. Moose, you want to
I just want to add just a quick, I mean, despite, I think I agree with what Doris has said, that given the pace at which these programs have been introduced, especially after 9/11, it's been very difficult for oversight to catch up with the growth, frankly. But I think despite those that comment, they actually, I think you have to give credit to the General Accounting Office and the Office of Inspector Generals that despite a time when Congress was giving more money to these agencies for doing even what they asked for, that they have actually tried to provide some modicum of oversight. I mean, the 287G program, which we talked about, obviously did reform as a result of the General Accounting Office report. ICE then did create a more uniform memorandum of understanding, which created a little more targeted approach towards than it did before. I think the Office of Inspector General has also similarly looked at the Secure Communities program as it has gone forward. I mean, these are new programs, many of them. The most important ones are really very fresh. So we haven't seen, I think, the kind of results that we would normally see.
I would just say on the detention system that I think that there have been kind of a, there's been a good faith effort, and certainly oversight and accountability has been a focus. But the system is so broad, immense, diverse, dispersed, that the word is really out on whether it's going to be successful or has been successful. And we're kind of an early stage of reform as well.
The lady over there, and would you please raise your hand this way I can put you down on my list. Thank you.
Yes. My name is Marjorie Zatz. I'm a professor at Arizona State University. This question is primarily for Don, and it follows on what you were just saying. In December, ICE announced their some new alternatives to detention policies and approaches. And I know it's early and all you can do is speculate, but I'm wondering what you think the consequence, what changes that might make in the patterns that you've been identifying, and particularly consequences for families.
Well, I mean, I think people don't understand the immensity of the alternative to detention system. It's now about 18,000 people, last we heard, and the last statistics we had were from early 2011, 18,000 people per night in the alternative system. In terms of assuring people's appearances in court and ensuring removals, it's been a highly successful system, 94% appearance rates, as have past community supervision types of programs. So these kinds of programs work, and I think the funding for them is obviously, they're obviously way more cost-effective and also more humane, although very restrictive, some of them, with home detention and office and home visits. The big challenge now, I think, will be to create more of a community-based infrastructure of the kind, the Vera Institute types of programs and Migration Refugee Services and other NGOs have run over the years. But they're very, very significant programs, and I think there is a good faith commitment to the idea of alternatives to detention.
The lady in the back.
Karen Grise. I wanted to ask a question about the growth in the enforcement leading to the need to identify, obviously, detention beds to hold the people that are the subject of the detention that Don and the others have been talking about. I mean, we haven't talked a lot this morning about the multi-year contracts with the state and local jails, and in particular with the private prisons for the bed space. And I wanted to ask if anybody wanted to comment on that piece of the infrastructure and the entrenchment of that in the enforcement policy going forward.
Well, you know, I would say that that's one of the major complicating factors of the detention reform effort, is that you started with 350 separate facilities, most of them states and localities, most of those privately managed, so that the and they were under contract for, you know, various periods of time. So what the reform efforts have been about is renegotiating those contracts and trying to build in some accountability into those contracts. And in fact, the numbers of number of contracts have decreased from something like 350 to 200. But this issue, again, of accountability and oversight is a real challenge for that system.
Thank you. The lady over here.
Hi. Wida Amir from National Asian Pacific American Women's Forum. Quick question on the intersection section of the findings. Have you come across any findings that looks at the intersection between the law enforcement, immigration enforcement, and child welfare system, particularly when we're talking about, you know, U.S. citizen children and parents who are in deportation and detention systems? And then I have one other question, and that's probably for Moose. When you're talking about, you know, the train has left sort of the station, especially with the 287Gs and such, would you say that though maybe the system not reversible, but is there room for pressure to continuously, you know, look at the policies, especially because they're a little bit more local rather than, you know, getting it increased to a federal sort of mandatory systems, reaching more states?
Sure. I mean, let me take the first part first. I mean, this is the talking about the intersection between immigration and the child welfare system. I think obviously people who advocate on behalf of children and families have been making this argument for a long time. And I think you began to see appreciation of that in the prosecutorial discretion memos that were issued by ICE in the last two or three years, that increasingly immigration officers are asked to look into the factors like children, especially children who don't have anyone else take care of them, to be taken into consideration whether they should be given higher priority in making a discretion not to remove them from the United States. I understand in certain jurisdictions there's actually a more ongoing relationship between state child development agencies and enforcement people to see whether there are appropriate ways where the children can be taken care of, and if they're not, then they will be given discretion exercise discretion not to remove a mother. Sorry? Yeah, I mean, this was the discretion of the respect not to remove parents as to be the factor. So I think that has gone into the mix of the criteria for using prosecutorial discretion only in the last 1 or 2 years. Again, it's one of those things I think we should be monitored to see whether it's doing better or not. The second part, I mean, we're all running out of time, so we didn't get time to say this, but, I mean, what we said here, obviously, in no ways is an endorsement of all these policies. I hope you appreciate that. We just laid out what the government has done. These are highly controversial programs. No one denies that. They have huge human costs. They have huge cost in terms of rule of law, in terms of due process and many other constitutional issues, which advocates, law enforcement officials, legal experts have raised all through this conversation. We're not minimizing any of that. In fact, we'd like to say that we hope we have done justice to those in our report. And those of you who read it, we hope you read those parts of the report in the same spirit as you read the rest of the report. But I think particularly about these programs, when I said secure communities has left the train station, it doesn't mean that there's no debate about how to reform the system. It only means that the debate should shift from trying to terminate the program on which a lot of political capital was had to see how we reform the program. And there are obviously many good ideas about reforming the programs. Like the 287G program, as Dimitri mentioned earlier, MPI issued a own report on 287G program. We asked for the termination of the task force models of the 287G program. And guess, lo and behold, DHS has decided to terminate, essentially phase out all the task force models. So as people are investigating these programs, I think improvements are also being talked about, and many of them actually are getting some hearing at the DHS.
Don, you have something?
Yeah, really, really quickly. I don't think that there's explicit findings on the intersection between immigration enforcement and child welfare. Of course, we considered and were concerned by, you know, things like the loss of custody and the severance of parental child relationships as a result of removals and detention. There is a short section on the family implications of removal, which, I commend to all of you.
Thank you. Since I don't see a hand, I think I can take the prerogative of the chair and ask a question. We have used, because that's all that the data allow, rather gross measures of effectiveness. And I'd like to ask the panel, in their research, are they seeing a movement toward more refined measures of effectiveness and success, where it's not about numbers, but it is about trying to get to what is most important in terms of immigration enforcement?
I'll start, and there, it's a big, broad topic, obviously. I think that there is a growing appreciation within the agencies that administer these programs that they do need to know more about effectiveness, outcomes, as compared to, in measurement terms, inputs. Fundamentally, what we're talking about here are inputs, funding, personnel, technology, growth, et cetera. It's much less possible to assess actual effectiveness. Probably the most important effectiveness measure that matters right now is border enforcement and the degree to which border enforcement actually is effective. That is something that DHS has been working on. They are struggling with the issues. They could probably be doing so more aggressively, but we cannot fault them for making the effort. But there's also going to be more and more pressure on them to be doing these kinds of analyses because of the funding questions. Once you get straight-line funding, you have to be, or even some decreases in funding, and in the last year or so there have been some decreases to some extent for some of the programs, you have to be much more rigorous about what really matters and how you do the work and what it is that you are going to continue to champion. The consequence enforcement at the border is a perfect example because a set of consequences are being used. Some of them are very expensive. Some of them are quite inexpensive. If you accept the idea of consequence enforcement, you then need to ask yourself which of these consequences best determines deterrence, and if that coincides with the most expensive, of course, then you have an argument for the most expensive, but it might coincide with the less expensive ones. Those are the kinds of questions that now need to be asked, that DHS needs to be held accountable to, but that oversight also needs to really focus on in order to refine this system and make this system produce the kinds of results that we've invested in.
Thank you very much, Doris. I'll make one final observation and then we'll close. One of the things that Doris alluded to, but the report is very strong on, is issues of data interoperability. You know, the day, and that has, you know, again, positives and negatives, but we have now gotten to the point where a line officer anywhere can have a real time access to all the information that the federal government, federal enforcement bases, agencies have available, and soon the DOD enforcement agencies will have data added to that system. The liberating aspect of it is that people at the border, or even as we extend the border beyond the border, will be able to make almost instant decisions about who should come in and who should not. I will leave the other concerns about such interoperability of systems, you know, for another discussion. I'd like to thank everyone for attending this event. I'd like to thank my colleagues here for fine presentations, the authors for a great report. And on behalf of all of them and the Migration Policy Institute, thank you for coming out, and thanks to our viewing audience. The report and our other work can be found on www.migrationpolicy.org. Thank you very much, and have a good day.